Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Jason Smith, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come and hang with us. How are you today, my friend?
Very good. It's always a pleasure to talk life and business.
Mate, I've been looking forward to talking to you for quite some time. Now, Jason, you have a huge group of practices back in motion, and you've gone from being a clinical physio to now being, I guess, CEO of a large conglomerate of practices. And of course, we'll explore that journey a little bit, but just for the sake of giving some context around that, can you just give us a little bit about your backstory, your overview? What was the impetus to grow such a business?
Yeah, I mean, when you try and encapsulate 40 years of living into a soundbite, I'm bound to miss something. But in simple terms, Jesse, I often introduce myself as something of a reluctant businessman and an accidental entrepreneur. From a very young age, was passionate and determined to get into a medical profession. And I actually thought I'd be working cross-culturally in the developing world. Had a really significant defining moment as a young fella, and I thought I'd become a medical missionary. And so I had my heart set on either medicine or nursing. I didn't even know what a physio was. And certainly dentistry didn't capture my attention at that time. And so I spent most of my schooling years really heart set on a life abroad. And then I was the most surprised to see my own story take an unusual turn in the first few years post-graduating as a physio, to find myself running my own small practice from a carport in a small suburban suburb of Melbourne,
yeah,
which became the beginnings of the Back in Motion Health Group story. And today, as your introduction just outlined, I find myself more a leader of teams and owner of businesses than a clinician. But the wonderful part of it is the business is an economic engine for us to do wonderful things, both here in Australia and across some of the poorest parts of the world. So in a strange way, I am living out that childhood dream, but just not the way I thought I would. So it's been a really interesting journey. And you know, I think you get to choose your own adventure. I feel like in part of this, I haven't chosen it. It's chosen me. But, you know, no regrets. Here I am and enjoying the ride.
Well, that's fantastic. And I'm a bit of a believer that life chooses you as well, because certainly in my own life as well, I had very different picture of where I thought my life would end up compared to where it has ended up. And I think that's part of the beauty of life as it unfolds before you. And I think, you know, just starting from that journey of the carport in, I think it's Wanturna, is that, if I'm correct?
Scoresby. Which nobody would have even known that suburb up until about 10 years ago, and somehow it made its way onto the Channel 10 weather map.
Oh, wow.
As that iconic suburb that the EastLink freeway ripped through. But up until then, nobody even knew where Scoresby was. But, yes, it's very close to Wanturna.
Yeah, lovely. So I wanted to ask you, you know, going from there to where you are now is obviously a massive journey. And of course, we can't condense that to a soundbite. We can't condense it probably to one podcast episode, but we're going to give it a red hot go. What I wanted to ask you around that is, when you were clinically hands-on doing the you know, patient-facing sorts of work, I guess firstly, did you enjoy that type of clinic work? Did you always know that you know you wanted to grow this kind of business? Or did, once you're in that physio clinic, did you kind of go, this is great, but I'm thinking there might be more to my life than being hands-on? What was that thought process as a young physio?
Yeah, so if I'm a reluctant businessman and an accidental entrepreneur,
yeah,
then I am definitely a passionate physio. So actually, I love the clinical work. It was the bit that really floated my boat. You know, as an undergrad, I got well and truly sucked into the vortex of the clinical research and best practice and evidence-based care. And I read broadly outside the core curriculum. And when I started to practice, nothing thrilled me more, Jesse, than, you know, 15 patients in a day and being able to get to the end physically exhausted but emotionally tanked up at being able to materially change outcomes in people's lives. And so I'm a clinician at heart, which has been a very interesting journey for me, because it's a huge frustration at times to be trapped in a boardroom or behind a keyboard or to be wrestling with financial statements or strategic documents, when actually my heart, my first love, was always in the consulting room. But when people ask me that question and I give a response like that, they think then I must have regrets. And there's a big difference between me missing the clinical work, which there are days I absolutely do, and nothing more so than when we launch a new practice and I walk through a beautiful state-of-the-art center and I think, oh, I could just work here. It would be such a dream.
Yeah.
But it's not regret. It's just I miss it. I love it. I enjoy being engaged still in it. But no regrets, because I could never achieve all that my heart wants if I just stayed as a clinician treating 15 patients a day. I would have made a difference in those handful of lives, but the leverage of influence I can have with the scale of our network gives me much greater impact, and there is something beautiful and fulfilling about that too.
It's interesting you talk about impact, because that was the first word that popped into my mind as well. Is, you know, it's one thing to sit in your four walls of a surgery or treatment room and think about the difference you make for those individuals, which is no doubt profound and impactful in its own way. But it seems to me that the people I speak to that ultimately scale up their business are the ones that are driven by a desire to have a broader impact. And though they might enjoy the clinical work, like you've said, you know, you enjoyed it and you miss it, but no regrets, because it's really a shift from, you know, impacting a small number of people to being able to, you know, increase that reach and impact larger volumes of people.
Yeah.
So it's true. Everyone I know who's scaled up, it's always been around impact, and it's quite a common theme. So, Jason, I wanted to ask you a little bit about those early days, because there are people listening to this podcast who feel like you, and there are people, probably young dentists, who are thinking, I want to have an impact just like Jason's had in physio. And, of course, there are people that we both know in dentistry that have had an impact of that regard. So, obviously, the role changes, and where you are now, you're in a, you know, a business where you're probably leading teams, managing people, growing individuals, developing other leaders. But there's obviously a lot of steps from A to B.
Yeah.
So when you go from one practice to a handful of practices, you know, four or five, what did that look like in that first embryonic step? What were you working on? What were you thinking about? What were the things that were, you know, occupying your mind at that particular point in the journey?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the most critical chapters in the scaling up journey, going from one to five rather than five to 50, because the lessons you learn and the principles you lay down and the disciplines you develop going from one to five are actually the crucial ones in my experience. And just to kind of quickly pick up one thought from your prior question, it's interesting because I actually never wanted to run a business. So even though I wanted impact, I didn't want to do it through commercial enterprise. In fact, I promised naively, I promised my wife on our wedding day, we were both 22 and 21 respectively. We had just graduated from physiotherapy, and my wife as an intensive care nurse. We both were committed to working overseas in the developing world, and I naively promised her I have no intention of ever crossing to the dark side and running my own private practice.
Oh, wow.
Of course, within 2 years, I was eating those words.
Yeah.
And every year since. So I would just encourage your listeners, firstly, that impact does not have to mean scaling up.
No.
In fact, it doesn't even have to be commercial enterprise. And of course, that's been the space in which I have found my vehicle. But for a lot of people, you can have impact in lots of different shapes and sizes, and it can be very significant. And I think that's the key for me. I was burdened from a young age, and it's a very God-centered spiritual mission, to be honest, but I was burdened by a young age with this idea of, I want my life to count. I want to make a difference. I don't want to live for myself. And that all might sound altruistic and a little bit cliche, but it really framed then when I felt like business was a possible avenue to achieve some of that. It framed a lot of the structure and the strategy. And so, of course, physios and dentists and other professionals will all have a certain amount in common in terms of the way they deliver their expertise, but then it's the culture and it's the framework and it's the strategy around that that really is the differentiator. So going from one to five meant that we had to think very, very carefully, firstly, about why. Why would we even want to bring five into our world? Mm. One practice is hard enough.
Yeah.
You know, as an owner operator, it's an all-consuming venture. It doesn't matter how many hours you've got in the day, they can all be consumed with one practice, one team. So how do you possibly divide yourself over five? And in fact, I was talking to someone only yesterday, a physio who rang me for some mentoring, and I kind of gave the analogy of, it's a little bit like raising a puppy. So when you raise a puppy or even raise a child, I've got four kids, when you raise a puppy though, you know, you go through the toilet training and the barking and the sleepless nights and the digging in the garden, all of the pain, and then you somehow train it to get to a point 9 months in where it's actually now a loyal, welcomed member of the family, and the puppy just returns love in spades, but you've gone through 9 months of pain and suffering to get there.
Yeah.
And then someone comes up with a bright idea in the family of having a second dog, and you forget all of the work you've got to train that puppy for it to become a disciplined member of the family. I think it's the same with businesses. You run one business, you put everything into it, you get it humming, it's systemized, it's process driven, customers, patients are getting great experiences, staff love the leadership and culture, and you almost drink your own Kool-Aid and think, this hasn't been that hard, because you've forgotten the 9 months or 9 years of intensive effort you have invested into it. And you start a second one thinking you just have to add water.
Mm.
But what happens is, in the second and sometimes third practice that you start quickly, you take shortcuts that you didn't take in the first one, and they underperform, they become a drag on your resources, they're unprofitable, the culture leaks, the vision drifts, the client or customer or patient experience isn't the same, and you end up bringing the primary flagship down with it. And so I think the disciplines around making sure you have a format for that business and you give similar attention and time and investment of effort into your second and third practice sets then a trajectory and a pattern for the rest of your scaling experience. But if you get those second and third wrong, or in my case, I did six in the first 2 years after deciding to scale. So I ran one practice for 5 years, one, just a single location, really honed my skills. I was just in my young 20s, so I had a lot of life to learn. And then when we decided to scale in the fifth year, we did six in 2 years, and I really proved the concept before we went on to a more accelerated scale. So hopefully there's some, you know, benefit in hearing that, because we suffered greatly in those 2 years getting a lot wrong, thinking that it's just going to be an easy extension.
Yeah.
And I think that's a trap.
I think you're absolutely right, because one of the things that I refer to often is called the Cinderella syndrome. And when we see people start that scaling journey, they fall into that trap that you've just articulated, and they end up with one beautiful princess and a couple of ugly stepsisters, right? And it's because the same discipline hasn't been applied, the shortcuts may have been taken, or perhaps the format wasn't honed well enough in practice number one for replication. So I want to just keep in this time period or this growth period of, you know, one to five, because I think that there's a lot of people who'll probably be in that space at the moment. Specifically, I want to ask you about those disciplines, the culture, the vision. And so I wanted to just get a bit of a clear idea of what you think are those key disciplines that need to be in place for in practice one to start with, but then need to be absolutely transposed word for word without shortcut into practices 2, 3, 4, and 5. What are those key disciplines, please, Jason?
So I'll give you a handful, and obviously there's potentially hundreds, but a couple of key themes that I think really need focus around is clearly you and I and your listener as the founder can't be in any more places than one at a time, yep. Right? It's just, it's a truism that we have to accept quickly. So I think one of the keys for us was that every location had a designated principal,
mm-hmm.
who had delegated responsibility so that that location could carry with decision-making and be empowered in some key responsibilities with me not having to be present. So that's a really important principle. Anyone who tries to oversee or carry a, you know, lion's share of decision-making over multiple locations, I think is being duped into believing they can do more than they really can, and they will bottleneck their own growth and performance.
Mm.
So it doesn't mean you won't have oversight. It doesn't mean you won't bring accountability, and it doesn't mean you won't have influence of leadership and vision, but you should empower an individual on a site basis.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be one of the things that we learned really early, because I think for a year I tried to run 5 on my own, and I spent more time in the car and on the phone but not physically present, giving all of myself to anyone at any given time.
And with that person, sorry to interrupt you, mate, with that person, you spoke about a clinical person. So is that in your case a physio, or would you have had a practice manager in each location?
Yeah, in our case it was a senior clinician, but it was a senior clinician whom we had identified had attributes beyond just clinical competency. So they had leadership attributes, and if they were a bit light in that area, that would be the focus of our resourcing around them. So we would develop them in their leadership attributes, because I think the role is more than clinical.
Mm.
But I think it serves well to have a senior clinical figure in our context, because it meant they could actually cover both sides of the ledger.
Yeah.
They could look after leadership and commercial elements, but as well as the most critical, which is healthcare, patient care.
Yeah.
A practice manager would have felt very limited in that second bucket.
Yeah, I agree. That's a really interesting point. So just on that, so when you've identified, because again, I just want to dive into that for a second, because there's obviously a talent identification process that you're running in that somewhere in there, and obviously a talent enhancement process as well.
I think it's the latter.
Yeah.
I really do. I'm a firm believer. It's a DIY project.
Yeah. So just before we get back to those disciplines, I don't want to take us off course, because we'll come back to that. But can you just speak to that for a moment? And that might be something we have to come back to as well, but I'm curious to ask about that.
Yeah, I spent the first 5 to 10 years of roughly my 25-year career trying to find the perfect person, you know, the golden goose, the right fit, doing all the profiling tools, doing all of the research and analysis, putting these poor suckers through 9 interviews. You know, because I think institutionalized into this idea that says you have to screen thoroughly and you have to personality profile to find the right shape peg for the hole you're trying to fill. I think there is benefit in a number of those approaches, but it would be entirely wrong to hold back the scaling of your business until you find the perfect person.
Exactly, yeah.
And so my approach in the last 15 years has been, I'm actually really just looking for the ABCs.
Yep.
Attitude, belief, and commitment, the ABCs. If you can demonstrate to me from past experience, not just future aspiration, but past experience, the ABCs, then I'm prepared to invest into you. And I have found there's no such thing as a recruitment of a 10 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
If there is, it's not because of me. It's because they are gifting past experiences to us. It's not because of anything I've done.
Yep.
I'd quite happily take a 7 or an 8 and spend the next 12 months getting them to a 9.
Yep.
And I can build great practices out of 7s to 9s.
Fantastic.
Excellent. You know, in a very crude sense. It's horrible to talk to people about people on that sort of system, but I trust your listeners understand just in a very basic concept that is my leadership mantra.
Look, and the thing that, you know, again, I feel like I'm taking us down a path. I'll come back to these disciplines we spoke about, but I always see that as you're scaling up, the role of the business owner shifts. You know, it becomes the builder of people and the developer of people to be able to help them, you know, fulfill their innate potential to put them in a role where they're going to thrive. And obviously that's what we're talking about, is that enhancement of a 7 or an 8 to a 9. And so, yeah, we'll come back to that in a minute because there's a lot of process around that as well. Again, I'd like to understand that in a second. But just so I don't derail us totally, the disciplines we spoke, coming back to those disciplines.
So another big theme as we sort of went from 1 to 6 would be making sure, and this is going to bore your listeners to tears because they will have heard it 1,000 times, but make sure you have a system. Make sure your processes. So my little soapbox speech on this is I want to systemize the routine and humanize the exceptions. Mm-hmm. So if I can get 80% of the format just in a process, automated as much as possible, you are going to start to get the leverage and the slipstream of the scale. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, your scale will work against you. You'll end up with 6 times the work.
Yeah,
and nobody wants 6 times the work. We want 6 times the benefit or 6 times the outcome, but we don't want 6 times the input. And if our scaling up gave us a linear return for linear input or proportionate return for proportionate input, we wouldn't scale, Jesse. We would just stick with one flagship practice and just run it really well.
Yeah.
So where I see a lot of people go wrong between 1 to 5 or 1 to 6 practices is they end up putting not only proportionate input, sometimes disproportionately greater input. It actually takes them more work than what you would expect the linear multiplier to be. And so systems are what safeguard you against that. And so I would suggest that, you know, you do the typical reflection after you've run your first practice for a few years and you work out all the things that went well and equally all the things you do differently. If you ran a second practice and you end up with 2 lists, 2 pages, and it's the beginning of your laundry list for your second endeavor. By the time you finish the second endeavor, you have now, you know, your 2 pages has become 20 pages because you're now intentional about the things that worked and the things that you do differently. By the time you do your third, you've got now a 50-page systems manual. And by the time you're onto your sixth, you've got an online automated 2,000-page document with resources and templates and all of the cheat sheets and scriptings that you know worked. And you have now the beginnings of a platform for much greater scale. Mm. But that's a thematic that if you don't get disciplined around early, you'll be chasing your tail for the rest of your growth story.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love the concept of just the pages of, you know, things you do differently and keeping notes and that and having that evolve into that comprehensive manual that you've obviously now perfected over years and years and years of operating that becomes almost like the Bible of operations. So I want to come back to a few things because there's so many little threads of conversation that we could pick up on. And again, ladies and gents, if you're listening to this, I just want to let you know that I came into this conversation with no preparation or questions. So this is a freestyle conversation. And I love that because we can go wherever we like. There's a few threads I'd like to come back to. The first one is around that talent enhancement process, because I think all of us understand the recognition of the importance of being able to develop people. If you're going to have any form of leverage, any form of scale, people are going to be a force multiplier for you. And what you've touched on, and this is my words, not yours, is that if we don't get this right, coupled with the systems and processes you've spoken about, is that complexity scales as much as the good stuff. So you have the potential to overly complicate things, the potential to create headaches, et cetera, et cetera. So when you've got a 7 out of 10 person, and again, I'm not trying to be reductionist around these people, but just, again, we all understand what we're talking about. What is it that you do specifically to be able to take someone who's demonstrated those ABCs, is a 7 out of 10, what's that talent process look like to go to a nine?
Yeah, it is full contact blood sport.
All right.
You know, there is nothing gentle or there is nothing passive about two people who eye each other off and say, we want to be better.
Yeah.
We want to do better. We want to be better. We want to become more. We're prepared to grow. We're prepared to have courageous conversations. We're prepared to be held to account. And so I talk about this as being, you know, hand-to-hand combat. This is what Sun Tzu might call the art of war, the real art of war.
Yeah.
Leadership face-to-face in a local team rather than this big pulpit leadership or, you know, corporate leadership where you might just send an email to 1,500 people. No. This is you and one other person having hard conversations every day about what your expectations are and what they need to do to get there. And I think one of the big, big things that I have learnt in helping develop others, and it's a coaching and facilitation role, Jesse. You know, it's not a dictatorial, instructional role. One of the big things I've learned is I have to let them fail. I have to give them enough rope that they might hang themselves but not kill themselves. And so I've got to be there to take the slack off the rope if they fall. But unless they are literally hanging in the balance for a little bit, feeling the weight of some of their decisions and the implications, you know, the consequences of some of their decisions, even if it's just momentary, then the learning effect is hugely diminished. Mm. So I need to give them the sensation of ownership, even if it's not the literal experience. And so, you know, that means saying to a lot of my colleagues who I'm trying to stretch, it starts, of course, with having mutual goals.
Mm.
And there's I think, a lot of poorly understood process around goal setting. People think that is a very simple, straightforward competency. Actually, I think true, effective goal setting is an art. It's a developed skill that takes intent. It's not flippant. It's quite intentional. It's very strategic. But once you've got mutual goals, it's giving people latitude to make mistakes on their own time, on their own logic, and then being quick to swoop in and help them debrief on that, so that actually the life that taught me becomes the life that teaches them.
Mm.
You know, we often talk about wisdom. You know, a wise person learns from their mistakes. Well, I think a more wise person learns from other people's mistakes. Yeah. But there's a nuance, there's a dance between still letting them feel some of their own pain in the journey and making sure there's really good framework, guardrails, debriefing opportunities, coaching sessions. For me, it's much more around mentorship of the why than the how.
Got it.
So it's coming back to, well, what are you trying to achieve? Why are you trying to achieve that? Can you help me understand what you'd do differently if you had a do-over? And really debriefing that carefully. And people are quick learners, mate. Let's face it, a 7 out of 10 is an intelligent person.
Yeah.
If the ABCs are right, then we all want the same thing. What they just lack is experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, better to learn from someone else's as much as you can.
Yeah. I think it might have been Steve Jobs. I hope I'm not misquoting this fable, but I think it was Steve Jobs who had one of his senior guys make a multi-million-dollar blunder, and he hauled him into the office and, you know, stripped him down for his foolish mistakes. And this executive was kind of close to tears and all but walking out, ready to pack up his desk and move on. And, you know, Steve Jobs grabs him in the 11th hour of that conversation and says, "Don't for a moment think I'm letting you go. You know, you have just learned. You know, I've just invested millions of dollars into your learning.
Yes.
Let's get out there and benefit from it." And I think that's actually got a really nice sentiment to it. If we can help people fail forwards, then we are really developing people the same way we raise our kids, mate.
Oh, that's exactly what I was just thinking. I'm listening to this conversation in my mind, thinking, I've got my 16-year-old daughter. Again, it's the same thing. We're giving her enough rope to be able to make some decisions, to feel the consequences of those decisions. But again, there's some strong guardrails in place to make sure it doesn't go too haywire. I really have enjoyed talking about those particular principles of developing people. And of course, you know, we're honing in on this period of 1 to 5, 1 to 6 practices. But again, it's another step again. So what was the next level for you from 6 to what? What was the next jump? Was it 6 to 10, 6 to 15, 6 to 20? What?
Yeah, for us it was 6 to 40.
Yep.
And that's a very specific number in our story, because between 6 to 40, somebody came in, well, at around the 12 practice stage, somebody came and tapped me on the shoulder and schooled me in this idea that, Jace, you can't run this from your kitchen table at home. You know, you can't fly this rocket by the seat of your pants. You need to professionalize your management. You need to, you know, put infrastructure in place. You need to spend some money, buddy. Don't run this like a backyard business.
Yep.
And we did what everybody else presumably is taught to do and put in a conventional top-down hierarchical model.
Yeah.
We had a board. I functioned as the CEO. We had a couple of general managers. I had, you know, a senior leadership team in all of the key functions of business, be it marketing, IT, business coaching, people and systems, et cetera, et cetera. Then we had all our support staff in our head office, and then we had the network of practices and their key people below that. And on paper, we looked like corporate Australia, you know, yep, just like yep, everybody else. And yep, it enabled us to grow. So, you know, I'm sounding a little cynical because I am, but
it was important at the time.
But in truth, it enabled us to grow from 6 to 40.
Perfect.
So we became a $25 or $30 million network. You know, physios don't have the same billing capacities as dentists, but you know, this was a sizable network, certainly the largest in Australia. And for all intents and purposes, right up until that 40 mark, I would have said to you, this has got legs to keep scaling as it is.
Yep.
You know, some of the thematics of that period were putting governance in place, having lines of accountability and reporting. Dare I say, bureaucracy became part of our protective mechanism, so that, you know, whilst we were delegating decision making into the practices, we had limits around that so that we, you know, kept the war chest, you know, liquid. We put tech and automation in place, Jesse, and that's a real key thematic of getting to the 40, because you can't possibly run all of your reporting and analytics manually. And so patient experience had to be more systemized because quality was having to be controlled. So they were the kind of the key themes of that next season. And, you know, again, I don't have regrets. I mean, it's just foolish to look back and think you could have done it better or differently, because I had to learn some stuff in that period. And, you know, there was a whole lot of, I still think, fundamentals we were putting in place. But between you and me and your listeners,
yeah,
I would never want to go back to that season again.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that period culminated, and maybe I'll pause and not give too much of that away in case you want to hover here a bit, but let me just kind of bookend that and tell you that season to 40 practices nearly killed us.
Oh, wow.
So at that point, I was ready to check out. I was ready to give it to you. And, you know, if you had rung me that day, Jesse, I would have given you the opportunity of a lifetime. You know, we were suffocating the soul of the business under the weight of the bureaucracy and top-heavy infrastructure. Even though it was part of what enabled our growth, it had a sting in its tail, and it, I think, stifled our creative and entrepreneurial spirit.
Well, I've just made a note of exactly that point, is how did you maintain that entrepreneurial flair? If you're an accidental entrepreneur, how did you maintain entrepreneurial flair while adding these layers of bureaucracy? Because it sounds like it's becoming a corporate.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what you become. And not because corporate's bad. I think, there's a lot of people out there who it's kind of tut tut on the corporate.
I don't mean it. Yeah, I'm just saying it becomes layers of rules and regulations and policies and procedures and stuff.
It does. And I think the pain in the realization of that is that that's not what we ever set out to be.
Yeah.
Not that that's wrong. It's just not who we were in our DNA.
Exactly.
It's not what enabled our initial spark of life, but we had grown into that. And we didn't especially like that way of life.
Yeah.
Even though we loved the people and we loved the clientele and we wanted scale and impact, we didn't especially want another 10 years of corporatized way of life.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what I would describe as our middle chapter. So 12 to 40, what a hellish decade. And I don't mean all bad, but boy.
Hard work.
What a steep learning curve.
Yeah. It sounds like you're crossing a desert in some respects because, you know, like there's this, you know, on the horizon, there's this picture of where you want to get to and what that looks like, but you're kind of going through some stuff. I'm curious to ask you how you've evolved through that process because, you know, we're talking a lot about the team and we're talking a lot about the themes, but what was that like for you?
Well, this is the reality. Founders who start organizations reproduce after their own kind.
Yeah.
And so in the first few years, I attracted people like me who I liked, who had similar attributes, who wanted similar things, who saw the world a similar way. And, you know, in that little naive bubble, everything felt beautiful. Of course, we had huge glaring deficiencies because we were all similar, but we also had great alignment. And then as you grow and you're composition of team expands and, you know, smart people help you recognize that you don't have everything you need to get the job done and you recruit people unlike you, you end up with a more balanced framework of people. But the truth is the organization still carries the heart and soul, I think, of the founding DNA. Mm. And so for me, for our organization to grow, it imposed on me faster growth than anybody else. So the personal journey in this is actually the real Shakespearean tragedy. You know, that's the real Hollywood plot. Yeah. I can talk all day about, you know, the principles of business, but actually the more interesting, the more personal and intimate conversation is the one that the individuals go on. And so I would say it has been specifically in Back in Motion, 20 years of gut-wrenching. It's like an ECG chart if I plotted it, you know. I have had incredible highs and earth-shattering lows, and I've spent most of my time oscillating between the two, not really enjoying steady state at any given time. And personally, my leadership has been challenged beyond what I thought was my breaking point multiple times. In fact, I would describe three defining moments in the 20-year story where I could have just as easily buried it in a box and gone and done something else. And I'm really glad I didn't, but that just gives you the sense of the desperation that you can get to at different points. And then you have a leadership breakthrough. Mm. You have a personal breakthrough, actually. Mm. And we just use the word leadership as a bit of a black box catch-all phrase, but you have a personal breakthrough that helps, in my case, helps me refocus on my purpose and do something different about how I'm working and how I'm living, which unleashes new potential for the whole organization because I set the lid. I really do believe that. I set the lid. And the day the organization wants to break through the lid that I've set and I can't lift, I'm really now having to hand this on to somebody more capable. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I have a thought actually around that. And again, the listeners on this show will be familiar with this thought, but Jason, I'd love your perspective on it. And that is the business will never outgrow the leaders. And my thinking around that is that if the business wants to grow beyond the leaders, either the leader needs to grow or the leader needs to step aside and let someone else take the reins. How do you feel about that comment?
Yeah, I think there is an undeniable interrelatedness or nexus between the leader's heart, vision, and capability. So they're all quite different things. And the organization's realization of growth. So I think there is an inextricable link between those two. I think organizations, and by that I mean dental practices and physio practices, right through to whole nations, if you think of them as a as an organization, I think they always have the potential to become more and better than the leader. And that's where I think your point rings true, that either the leader has to adapt faster than the organization's potential for growth, or a new leader is required to realize the potential.
Yeah.
But I've always thought, and I think John Maxwell, you know, one of my favorite writers leadership matters, you know, he's a prolific author on these matters. He always talks about the fact that the leader sets the bar. And that's a pretty weighty responsibility for all of us to take, because some of us are pretty poor leaders. And, you know, I'm speaking of myself. You know, our leadership attributes can be left wanting on some days, and we're the ones setting the bar. You can't give the organization something you don't have. You can't expect of your team something you haven't been able to model or give. It doesn't mean they won't gift you with something, but it's an unrealistic expectation. And so it puts a huge burden of responsibility on the founders and owners to make sure they are more committed to ethical and integrous leadership than they are committed to clever business strategy.
Absolutely. Just in your own leadership journey, Jason, where do you think, obviously I'm assuming that you're fallible like the rest of us, and I'm assuming there's been a misstep or two along the way. Can you think of something that you just, with the benefit of hindsight, you'd look back on and go, that was not my finest hour, that is going to be useful in terms of sharing so that other people can learn from that, rather than, you know, I don't mean it in a self-flagellation point of, you know, view, but where's the lesson in that? What would be something?
Well, I have so many to choose from, Jason.
Well,
it's hard to pick a shining example because they're all so noteworthy. To be honest, if I didn't just focus on a, you know, individual instance, but more this presiding theme.
Yeah.
The biggest shortcoming that I think I fall for time and time again, and it probably had its most pronounced impact during that second chapter when we were going from 12 to 40, because I learned something pretty sensational at 40 that has unleashed us to 140. But the thing I think, I've had so many people coach me over the years that, Jace, you're too soft, you're non-confrontational, you believe the best in people, you're naive, actually, Jace. You're very naive, you're unreasonably optimistic. And as a result of all of those veiled compliments, because they're not really compliments at all, they have a dark side, all of those comments kind of converge to saying that I have spent a lot of my commercial career carrying this sense that I have a big exposure towards people who would want to take advantage of me.
Oh, wow.
And I have had lots of tangible experiences where people have taken advantage of me. And so this is me being really candid.
Yeah.
And I hope my words don't come back to bite me in the future. But I think the area where I have failed so often over and over is that because I have had that caution given to me, I can actually go to the extreme other end when I'm cornered or I'm feeling under pressure, when I'm not at my best, and I can actually sense that the world is trying to get me and I become unreasonably rigid. And that actually is a regret. So I have multiple scenarios, multiple specific circumstances where I think, oh, Jace, I could have played that so differently. I could have been a lot more forgiving or a lot more flexible in the way we considered the next step, rather than it having to be a black and white scenario. And I think that really was the theme of that 12 to 40 years. I mean, everything was rigid. You know, we have a system, we have a process. If you don't fit the mold, it doesn't make you a bad person, but you're just not welcome on the team, because, you know, I had it drilled into me that I had to be much more disciplined. And I think some of that is right, but I took it to an extreme.
Yeah.
And I've spent the last 10 years intentionally trying to round out those edges. And I think it's given our organization freedom of movement. And I'm really grateful for the people who took a risk on me and brought all that to my attention. But I hope that makes sense.
Believe me, it makes perfect sense on so many different levels for me. It feels, in a sense, you've been reading my mail. But I can relate to that on a very personal level. I wanted to ask you, just because I think the story would be incomplete without asking you, what was that turning point at 40 that unleashed the next phase of growth? Because there's obviously some inflection point there. And could you just describe what that insight or learning or pivotal moment was?
A massive one. So if I had my first defining moment at 10 years of age, which kind of set me on this idealism of wanting to serve the poorest of the poor, I had my second big defining moment a few years after starting the business and deciding to scale for impact. This third defining moment happened when we got to 40 practices, give or take. I actually gave myself, or my wife compelled me to take some self-appointed long service leave. We went away for 3 months, went overseas, came back, and this management structure that we had been serving under for, you know, that 8 years or so had completely imploded under the egotistical and very heavy-handed management regime of those who I had left in charge. I mean, they were employees. They didn't have equity. They had no founder's DNA, but they were very talented people. Mm. But in my absence, me having stepped out, being an absent father for 3 months, it was just enlightening to see how much chaos and violation of cultural attributes went on. And I had the objectivity to see it with fresh eyes when I returned to the business. And I literally had four people waiting at the door of my office on my return saying, they're either going to resign or I've got to fix this. And they were some of my, you know, soul people who had worked with me for a decade. And I knew then that something was fundamentally wrong. So that was the wake up, the defining moment. And I went through 12 months of reading everything I could get my hands on in terms of leadership and management literature, talking about all of the ways you could restructure organizations. I got into the psychology. I got into the science of it. And I ended up just with a blended kind of my own creation of what we have now called One Team, which is a spherical organizational model. So not a hierarchical top-down, but a spherical model. And we took 3 years training that into our people. And I describe it not as a restructure, Jesse, I describe it as a leadership revolution. Because of the point you made earlier, it was the people who had to go on this intense journey of re-understanding how we have influence and impact, and not using titles and authority to tell people what to do, but releasing creativity back into our organization. I overnight detitled my entire management team. I blew up the conventional structure, and we started to bring in this new ethos of leadership over management. So we don't want a management culture. We want a leadership culture. Mm. And that's not meant to be cute. That actually means something very specific in our story. And we put that in place in 2013. At the same time, we set a very ambitious, arguably unreasonable objective of doubling our organization in 3 years. Wow. That had taken us more than 12 years previously to build. And we achieved that because our management structure no longer was an inhibitor and our leadership culture became an enabler. And to this day, I mean, we're on version 5.0 of that,
sure,
you know, that incarnation. But I think it's just been a wonderful returning to our entrepreneurial roots and saying the best of us comes out when we give each other freedom to fail, freedom to move, empowerment to make decisions. We're not without structure, but we've got much more freedom of expression within our structure.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It reminds me actually of something I read around the US military. It was General Stanley McChrystal.
Yeah, it's a great book. Teams of Teams.
Is that essentially what you're describing there?
Well, it's funny because I read that book after I published one of my own. So I was giving some keynotes on this story that you're asking me about now at some industry conferences, and I ended up getting in conversation with a publisher, and they wanted that story told with a case study, and I ended up documenting 50 lessons that we learned in that three-year intense revolution. And somebody gave me Stanley's book at the conclusion of that whole process, and I think there are lots of congruent themes between what we were living and what he described, and he's very articulate. He's an exceptional author.
Yeah, he's very good.
He obviously has a very sophisticated explanation for a lot of what they experienced, whereas ours just became a lived reality.
Yeah.
But, yes, there's a lot of similarities. So for your listeners, if they want to read Team of Teams, and the book I wrote is called Outside In, Downside Up Leadership. And it's because we felt like we went into a washing machine for 3 years and got, you know, pulled in all different directions, but we came out clean and tidy, and it became the impetus for new growth.
Yeah, and just for the listener, because I've got the notes here around the book as well, it's Outside In, Downside Up, 50 Insights from a True Story of Remarkable Organizational Change. If people would like to get that book, mate, where's the best place for them to grab a copy and to read it? Amazon or local?
Oh, look, you'll get it on all the on-site bookstores. There's audiobook, there's ebooks, there's hard copies in most of the major Australian retailers. So and if you're really stuck, you just go to my website, jasontsmith.com.
Perfect. Jason, your story is remarkable. And what I think is remarkable about this story is that very early seed around the altruism, wanting to have impact, to do things for other people, to live a life of service, has really been a theme that's come through whatever stage of your growth, whether it's one practice, one to six, six to 40, 40 to 140 plus, right? I can see that theme going through. And what's remarkable to me is not just the business that you've created, but the person you've become and needed to become to create that business, to fulfill that vision. And ultimately, I feel, this is just a personal philosophy, that half of the vision, or the realization of the vision, is not just the realization of the vision, but who you become or who you need to become to fulfill it. And I think that's a really remarkable journey. So I really wanted to say thank you for being so open, candid, and generous with your journey and your self-expression around that. So thank you.
You're most welcome. It's always fun. It'd be great to hear more of your story someday.
All right. Thank you, mate. I really appreciate your time and look forward to catching up soon.
Excellent.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/Savvy Dentist.